I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We look ahead in the war-fogged Middle East this hour with some of the people who could have steered a much better path a generation ago. First, a word from our president. This week, bragging about the assassination of an Iranian general, but then pulling up short on a path toward war with Iran.
For far too long, all the way back to 1979, to be exact, nations have tolerated Iran's destructive and destabilizing behavior in the Middle East and beyond. Those days are over. Iran has been the leading sponsor of terrorism, and their pursuit of nuclear weapons threatens the civilized world. We will never let that happen.
Our guests are a strong sample of my own honor roll in commentary on these things. All told, there were 33 specialists in strategy, diplomacy, Middle East history, and such, who paid for op-ed space in the New York Times as President George W. Bush was ginning up war against Saddam Hussein. September 2002, 6 months before the war actually began, these scholars' warning ran under a headline I'll never forget: War with Iraq is not in America's national interest. Each one of their six bullet points proved true in the real world. Saddam was, in fact, a bad old client of the United States, had no part of the 9/11 attack. We could win a war with Iraq, obviously, these professionals stated, but we would never get out of the mess we had made. I pinned that ad over my desk forever after, a model of realism and clarity that nobody gets thanked for, telling the emperor his war has no clothes on, not a chance of military or political or moral victory. And so we call them when we can to second-guess wars and rumors of war. They're all here tonight. Three of them are John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago, Steve Walt at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Steve Van Ivera at MIT, here for the hour. For you three signers of that remarkable ad, I might say you almost understated the folly and the repercussions of that war. Round the horn, starting with you, John Mearsheimer in Chicago, what would you add today about the foreseen and unforeseen damage of the Iraq war?
Well, there were a number of things that happened that we couldn't anticipate at the time. For example, the creation of ISIS, I think, was an outgrowth of that war.
Good point.
And there was no way of anticipating that. I don't think, if I had to do it all over again, I'd overstate the case or make the case stronger than we made at the time. I think we told the facts in a rather cold and calculating way. And for purposes of maximizing our impact, I think it was important not to use hot rhetoric and not to overstate the case. And for that reason, I think the ad was well written, and it was as effective as it could be, although it was not very effective. We were at most a speed bump on the road to war.
I'm glad you mentioned ISIS. There's also these collateral failed states all around Iraq, Syria, Yemen. Barack Obama's copycat unlicensed wars that smashed Libya, still beating up Afghanistan. Not to mention the normalization of a certain kind of blunder and deception, pseudo-expertise, a privatized security apparatus, and its media. Stephen Evero, what would you add to the list of fallout items?
Well, the general radicalization of the region. We saw a general rise of Islamic militants. We really made the whole al-Qaeda problem worse. As John says, you know, the most immediate and obvious thing is that this war created ISIS. And the listeners should you know, make sure they fully take aboard that there never would have been an ISIS if we hadn't smashed the authoritarian order in Iraq. There was no terror group operating in Iraq. None.
ISIS formed out of the old Sunni power base that was dethroned by our war, right?
Correct. And they were basically instigated and you know, shall we say, incubated out of the foreign influence of al-Qaeda. But there was no chance for any organization like ISIS to form or start in Iraq, and no sign of any starting before we invaded. So that's they originally were called al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was their original brand. And then they rebranded after we basically beat them back and hammered them hard. But then they moved over to Syria. And then after they built up in Syria, they came back and conquered a big territory in Iraq also. All of it due to one thing, our invasion.
Steve Walt, you were strong in arguing the policy. What surprised you in the real world here?
Well, to me, the most remarkable thing about what's happened, first of all, in Iraq and then since, is how little the country has learned. I mean, first of all, no one was held accountable.
Little our country.
Yeah, how little our country, the United States, has learned. With the exception of Judith Miller, a reporter for the New York Times who eventually lost her job because of her reporting, no one else. I mean, no government officials, media pundits, think tank intellectuals suffered any career damage for having advocated strenuously for what turned out to be a disastrous war. In fact, many of them have done, repeat service, have moved up. Really remarkable example of.
And believe it or not, Tom Friedman, who sponsored that war, is still spouting the same garbage in the New York Times.
If we started,
as if nobody noticed.
If we started down the list of people who have not learned anything and remain in prominent positions, we'd use up the full hour. Second, the country is still over-reliant on military force, still believes that the big stick can solve all problems, still largely disinterested in genuine diplomacy. So President Obama's negotiation of the nuclear deal, which was in fact a very good deal for the United States, is now an aberration, not the normal way we try to do business. We still see government officials lying to us with near impunity, Secretary of State Pompeo being a good example of that. And remarkably, we haven't learned that overthrowing foreign regimes, even governments we don't like and have reasons to be at odds with, doesn't solve the problem. It tends to make the problem worse. Again, Barack Obama does Libya in the wake of our experience in Iraq, and he tries to do Syria. He tries to foment regime change in Syria. Not very hard, but that's the American position. And again, the results of this have never been pretty, whether it's in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, or elsewhere. So we haven't learned that lesson either.
Yeah, it seems to me there's a generally depressing effect on the whole tone of life in this country. And I think it's partly out of that depression that, oddly enough, Donald Trump rises. But go back to an interesting point you make there, that there was a whole new Iraq war career path opened up, and they're still on it, not to mention Fox News. One of my least favorite commentators, Andrew Sullivan, made his big move as a war blogger. He's repented considerably since then, but the damage is done. In terms of commentary, public understanding, what's been missing in the punishment of those characters?
Well, certainly not. The fact that many of the prominent advocates remain very influential commentators now on our foreign policy. So you see Bret Stephens at the New York Times, previously at the Wall Street Journal. You see Max Boot, who was a very prominent advocate for the war, is hired by the Washington Post. And this is not when the war looked successful. He gets hired from them long after we'd all realized the war was a disaster. And what's interesting about all of these cases is these are people who are largely unrepentant. It's not like
true.
I mean, Sullivan is an exception where he has sort of come clean about his errors. You know, what could I have been thinking is sort of his view now. But most of the others have never admitted that the war was a mistake. They blame Barack Obama for having lost the wonderful war that they had given us, which, of course, is nonsense. And that's, again, a sign that there's something seriously wrong with the strategic conversation in this country where we can't even have a modicum of accountability for people who got a very, very big decision badly wrong.
Where is the strategic conversation, John Mearsheimer? Nobody more respected out there, I will say about you, than your very self. You've been a brave, way ahead of the game guy. Who's reading it? Who's following it? Who's arguing with you?
Chris, I just want to make one very quick point on what's going on here and talking about learning and what's happened over time. It's important to understand that after 2001, we launched two major offensives into two particular countries. We invaded Afghanistan and we invaded Iraq, and both eventually turned into failures. And then we changed our modus operandi, and we're no longer invading countries. What we're doing is overthrowing governments in other ways. We got deeply involved in Syria, although the press doesn't pay much attention to it, but not by sending in ground forces and invading the country the way we invaded Iraq. Instead, we supported the rebels. We gave them money. We gave them training. We worked with the Turks, the Saudis, and so forth and so on to overthrow Assad. And then with regard to Libya, we basically used air power to help overthrow Colonel Gaddafi. And what's going on here is that the United States is continuing to interfere in the politics of countries in the region for the purposes of doing social engineering, but we're not invading countries. And you see this with regard to Iran, because a lot of people say, are we going to invade Iran? Are we going to have a major war with Iran like we had with Iraq? The answer is almost certainly no. What we will do is use air power, cruise missiles, and so forth and so on, because we did learn that invading countries is a bad idea, but we did not learn that social engineering is a bad idea.
These are big, big changes. I want to throw in a low personal point here, but who would have imagined that after the war in Iraq, our war coalition would consist of three incredibly unsavory people? Our own president of the United States waiting Senate trial on the House's impeachment, an Israeli prime minister who's fighting criminal charges of corruption, and a Saudi autocrat, bin Salman, who has a prominent critic literally torn limb from limb and then ground up. And then below them, a cast of people we really don't know at all. Mike Pompeo at State, Mark Esper at the Pentagon, General Mark Milley at the Joint Chiefs. I mean, who's running this world now? Maybe you, Steve, than ever.
Well, the whole question of how Trump is dealing with the world is a deep subject on its own. We've never had a president like this. It's hard to define any concept of national interest that he pursues other than his own personal interest. And the reasons, and then the way he goes about it, which is always befriending the autocrat, the thug, the liar, the most corrupt people he can, while opposing Democrats, decent people, those who run their countries honestly and for the national interest. It's a very striking pattern. Explaining it is hard.
We're thinking about Iran, but also looking back at unlearned lessons from the war in Iraq. Coming up, the Iranian-American social scientist Valentin Mogadam checking vital signs on her old country and her new one. This is Open Source. The question in the Iraq war quickly became, how could a country as smart as ours is supposed to be have signed on to a fiasco so every way wrong? Our guests this hour were rare, bold voices in the expert class who saw catastrophe coming and said so. But there were also the experienced worldly friends here and abroad that we didn't consult. And Valentin Mogadam is our guest to play that part, to help us see ourselves as others see us, as the poet Bobby Burns put it. She was born in Tehran during the Shah's reign. She was trained in sociology in Canada and the U.S. She's now a professor with a wide range of projects at Northeastern University in Boston. Welcome, Valentin. What are you observing about this country you adopted, this country whose culture Iranians are said to love and know much better than we know Iran? What do you see in old uncle here?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. What do I love about this country? Quite a bit, especially jazz, blues, and rock and roll. And I think that a lot of Iranians feel the same way. I think we feel less sanguine about other aspects of American life, about American history and American foreign policy in particular. Those of us who come from Iran, whether we know this through personal experience or our family experience, or we heard this from our parents or grandparents, we remember 1953, the coup d'etat against Premier Mossadegh. This was a time of intense American anti-communism, and he was taken out on the flimsy charge of probably trying to bring communism to Iran. But in fact, he was not a communist. He had very bad relationship with the Tudeh Party, the Communist Party of Iran.
And he was taken out, we must emphasize, by the CIA, Kim Roosevelt leading the charge,
quite
spreading $100 bills all over Tehran until he quit.
Quite so. And at the time, it wasn't really known that the United States, that the CIA was behind this. Everyone knew the role of the of Britain, but that was very, very upset with the nationalization of the oil industry and so on. But that came to light, you know, some years afterwards, and it was it's been a very unfortunate thing. And I think many Iranians have been very, very skeptical of the United States and very suspicious of the United States ever since then. But there have been other things along the way as well.
The worst part is that it's been lost to history. Nobody ever mentions that the original sin in our policy in the Middle East was toppling a very promising democratic post-war regime
in Iran.
And
we'll never forget it. We can never forget it.
How do we suppress it? I don't know. Do you, Steve Walt, how we get that out of our memory? That talk about blood on the hands. I mean, that we created, we imposed the Shah and his Savak and a whole lot of bad economics on the people. And for 25 years until the Islamic Revolution, and now Trump talks about the blood on their hands as if we're children
something. All countries, and this one in particular, are bad at remembering our own history. We tell ourselves a rather whitewashed view of our own past conduct. So an event like the 53 coup, which looms very large in the minds of Iranians, is one that's a footnote in American history at this point. And that's true of many things that have had happened subsequently as
well. I didn't want to interrupt Valentina, and specifically on this question of the entrenched behavior, mm-hmm. of which that was a kind of model.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
I worry about, sort of a late imperial phase of our mm-hmm. own glorious history, mm-hmm. you were saying, about us.
And who can forget that the U.S. practically gave Saddam Hussein the green light to invade Iran in 1980,
right.
Starting a bloody 8-year war. It just so happens, by the way, that, I mean, people are wondering these days why it is that Iran and Syria have such good relations. Well, during the Iran-Iraq War, Syria was among, I don't know what, two or three countries that supported Iran during that war. And every other country was opposed to it. It was
again,
a bloody
blood
war.
Blood on hands, a million casualties.
A million casualties.
Vast numbers of women and children.
Absolutely. The destruction. I mean, my late father lived there, and he would be calling and writing us from time to time and telling us about the aircraft going overhead and so on, and the destruction of the means of production of both countries and the bombardments and so on. I mean, it was quite awful. It was quite atrocious. And then I would actually like to bring in another factor here in terms of the U.S. and its rather nefarious role in the region, broadly speaking, and that's Afghanistan and its role during the Afghan War.
Afghan War starting
in 1901. Oh, no. I would go back to 1979-80.
Oh, sorry. Of course.
Right. So the Afghan War, so there was a revolution that took place in 1978. And again, American virulent anti-communism decided that, you know, that regime had to go as well. And it worked through the United States, worked through its proxies, in particular Pakistan and also Saudi Arabia, to foment an Islamist armed rebellion. I mean, the U.S. was on the side of a group of tribal Islamist rebels, later called the Mujahideen, who were opposed to girls' schooling.
Including bin Laden, probably.
Well, bin Laden was trained in a CIA camp along the border with Pakistan. And so that was the origin of Al-Qaeda. So the United States has played a very, very, nasty role. I often sit and wonder what Iran and actually the region would look like had the 1953 coup d'etat not occurred. I often wonder what Afghanistan and the rest of the region would look like, too, had the United States decided to leave Afghanistan alone in 1978, 1979, 1980, let it deal with its rebels, the tribal Islamist uprising, and at the very worst, Afghanistan would have been, another Uzbekistan or Tajikistan or one of the other stans. But it would not have been the essentially failed state that it still is today. So the 1980s and then, of course, the invasion in 2001 and then with the resurgence of the Taliban in 2006, it's just been one bit of bad news after the other. So I feel very, very badly about Afghanistan. I was there in January, February of 1989 when the modernizing progressive government was still in place, but it was besieged and the Soviet troops were leaving. And it took another 2 years. And finally, that what was, in, to my mind, a very, very interesting experiment collapsed and failed.
That's extraordinary testimony, and I'm just so glad you're here. I want others, though, to jump in, especially on this picture of not just the sins of the United States. We all have sins on our record, but a pattern over the long post-war period of a deep design that keeps popping up here, there, everywhere. Immense power and investment and government sponsorship, and in the end, military threat, too. I mean, we don't have a very sophisticated sense, Stephen, here of even who we are in the world.
I think the sort of core, think of an original sin since the Second World War, or the sort of most central mistake, biggest blunder the U.S. has made, was extending the Cold War into the developing world. George Kennan and Walter Lippmann and some of the military, like Matthew Ridgway, originally conceived of containment as something that was an effort to keep the Soviet Union, but not other leftists, from expanding into industrial areas, but not third world areas. And the great mistake in the Cold War was to globalize it and to define East Asia as a zone for the Cold War.
Did somebody choose that strategy?
Well, I mean, how did it happen?
I mean, thank God there was no shooting war between the United States and the Soviets. But did somebody say we'll vent our differences in Africa and the East?
Well, some people trace it back to the Truman Doctrine. And when the Cold War was first conceived by Kennan, it was, as I said, it was focused on keeping the Soviets out of Western Europe. Senator Vandenberg then met with Truman before Truman gave the big speech kicking off the Cold War. And Vandenberg said to Truman, if you want to mobilize the American people for this struggle, especially for the Marshall Plan, which was going to cost a ton of money and would sound weird to Americans, he said, you've got to scare hell out of the American people. And then Truman gave a speech in which he more or less defined the entire world as the battlefield and the entire left as the opponent. There's a scholar at Cornell.
Walter Lefebvre?
No, the overselling argument that the United States, you've got to oversell both the threat and the solution if you want anything to become policy in the USA, because we have so many choke points in our political system. So instead of saying we have a finite problem here, Soviet expansion, and a finite goal, keep them out of Europe, this is a finite policy. Instead, it had to be defined as a much grander problem against a much greater threat that required much greater effort just in order to get the policy sorted.
I like this. John Mearsheimer, I'm wondering, can you help us sort of see the whole post-war period as in some sort of a large tableau?
Well, is Steve pointed out what happened in the early part of the Cold War is that we decided to go beyond protecting Eurasia, the areas where military power was concentrated, and get involved all over the planet. And I would add to what Steve said that the domino theory, I think, added to that. A lot of people believed that if an area in the Third World fell, another area in the Third World would fall. The dominoes would continue to fall, and that would affect those crucially important areas. So therefore, we got involved here, there, and everywhere during the Cold War. Then the Cold War ends. The glacis plates shift, and you move from a bipolar world to a unipolar world where you have a single great power. And that single great power no longer has to worry about great power competition with an opponent like the Soviet Union, because by definition, there's only one great power in the system. So great power politics is taken off the table. Nevertheless, we had developed an instinct for intervening all over the planet during the Cold War, which carried over into the unipolar moment. Except I believe the rationale changed somewhat. During the Cold War, we intervened in places like Iran in large part because we thought it was a burgeoning communist state. It wasn't, but that's what we thought. That's why we intervened in Chile, Guatemala, and so forth and so on. But in the post-Cold War world, the threat was not communism. The threat was mainly terrorism. And it was the belief that we could do social engineering at the end of a rifle barrel because we were the unipolar.
There was no other great power to stop us. Mm. Frank Fukuyama told us that we had the wind at our back. It was the end of history. Liberalism is the wave of the future. So we thought we could run around the planet, knocking off regimes, doing easy social engineering, and turn the planet into a sea of liberal democracies. This is what the Bush Doctrine was all about. And there is a certain continuity with the Cold War, because we were running all over the planet during the Cold War as well.
Well, I would say
Steve Austin. Yeah.
Let me just add two more points to the points that John and Steve have already made. One is that there's been a tendency throughout this period in the Cold War, but also afterwards, to see our enemies as part of some kind of ideological monolith, that they're all in cahoots. As Steve mentioned, you know, we saw that all leftists of all kinds were somehow secret agents of the Kremlin. Well, in the post-Cold War period, that's now become Islamism. The idea that Muslims everywhere are somehow secretly aligned or collaborating, that all of these various groups, many of whom dislike each other intensely, are somehow secretly conspiring, that Iran is leading this vast monolith in the Gulf region and in the Middle East that is designed to come after us in lots of different ways. The second concern, again, begins in the Cold War, remains true today, is this obsession with credibility, right? That the United States can never back down, can never accommodate an adversary, has to fight in places that are of strategic, not consequential at all, in order to prove to the world that we'll continue to fight in other places and that might matter somewhat more. That this obsession for going after every tiny little adversary everywhere because we have to maintain our reputation. We can't let anyone be emboldened by a failure to respond.
Of course, I'm thinking Vietnam. And of course. The war, the bombing, the devastation continued long after the war made any sense at all.
When Barack Obama decided not to attack Syria after Assad crossed the red line, immediately people began to say, well, this will embolden our adversaries all over the world. This will make North Korea do something bad. This will let Putin do something bad.
But who said it? I still wonder.
It's the same people who have been selling American efforts to manage or run the entire world for the last 40 or 50 years. The belief that we have to act everywhere, and if we ever refrain from responding, that's suddenly going to imperil our security, cause our allies to abandon us, and leave us isolated and alone. This is a standard sort of trope within hawkish rhetoric, and it's all part of sort of inflating a set of threats so that Americans feel they have to keep fighting or that they won't be safe.
I think it's more about an obsessive concern with maintaining American power and hegemony. I'm not sure that American interventions around the world, whether in the Global South or other places, was really about creating a sea of liberal democracy. I see more continuity across, you know, the decades, certainly ever since, you know, World War II, the end of World War II, when the United States took over from Great Britain as basically the global hegemon, and then try to, you know, marginalize the Soviet Union and check its influence too. But I think that the goal has always been American power, American authority, and American hegemony across the world, and it really is basically about that. And it's really not about democracy. It is about open markets, maintaining capital accumulation around the world, and whatever is good for business is good for America.
I want to just throw in another key word that we don't use much. You say control, hegemony. We don't say empire, as the Brits did in a very proud way. But it seems to me what we're seeing is an advance of the whole imperial fact in our lives. From my angle, George W. Bush, selected by the Supreme Court, not elected, marked a transition out of the Republican sense of ourselves, power of the people, by the people, for the people, etc., into a kind of soft, but not so soft, empire. Trump is trying to talk us, Tuesday morning, it seems clear to me, he's trying to talk us into a deeply imperial notion of ourselves, sort of innocent folk, but unilaterally, militarily super powerful in the world, and basically forget the rest of our identity.
I count on you, especially, Valentin, to speak to this sort of becoming old, distracted superpower about the fate of empires. Mm. Even introduction to ourselves as emperors.
Mm. Empires do rise and fall. The United States actually has been encountering some serious challenges. The United States emerged from World War II, of course, as the dominant power. It was not destroyed like the destroyed like the Soviet Union or most of the European countries. It came out on top. It was economically very strong. It was the leader of the free world, so to speak. Its legitimacy, its authority, its credibility was very strong around the world and so on. That has changed. That has changed over time. Economically, it is still strong in many ways, but it is also challenged by, these days, China. Politically, and ideologically, it has lost a great deal of credibility, a great deal of legitimacy, a great deal of authority around the world. And what does it have to fall back on? Its military, because it is obsessed with maintaining its hegemony and control.
Last word, Steve DeNever, before the break.
Great powers, history shows great powers have a chronic tendency to overexpand. And the greatest threat to great powers, shown by the record of the last 250 years, is their own tendency to exaggerate the threats they face, go on a belligerent campaign to deal with those threats, thereby conjuring up the threat that they were only imagining at the beginning.
Stand by. Coming up, this imperial transformation of the United States in our lifetimes and what it says about our future. This is Open Source. Benjamin Franklin famously remarked to a woman who asked him about the final draft of the U.S. Constitution. He said, "We've given you a republic if you can keep it." The question in our reckless, imperious, imperial Trump time is whether we have lost that character. John Mearsheimer from the Heartland, Chicago. Tell us about ourselves, who we are, who we seem, who we've taken to be, who we're becoming.
Well, it's very hard to say at this point in time, in large part because it's so difficult to make sense of Donald Trump. As Steve Van Everest said earlier in the conversation, he's sui generis. We've never seen anything like him. And I think in addition to what he's doing on the foreign policy front, and even in terms of his domestic politics, the actual policies don't matter that much. It's sort of what he's doing to sort of threaten and to undermine American values. And one wonders if he gets reelected, what, you know, now would be five more years of Donald Trump would mean for the body politic. I mean, I think a political entity like the United States is rather fragile, and you have to be very careful how you handle it. And I think someone like Trump brings a lot of dynamite with him to the table, and five more years, he could do a lot more damage. I'm much more worried about Trump and where the country's going in terms of domestic politics than I am worried about foreign policy. The fact is the United States is the most powerful state in the history of the world, and it's a remarkably secure country. The reason we can go around the world doing all these stupid things and continue to do all these stupid things is because the truth is the United States never gets hurt very much in the process. It's other people we end up killing. Mm-hmm. It's murder and mayhem in the Middle East that we create. But the United States basically escapes without that much damage. So foreign policy is not really the issue here. The question is, what is Trump doing inside the American body politic? Is he corroding those democratic traditions that matter so much for holding this political entity together? And furthermore, Trump himself is a manifestation of a series of trends or forces that are at play inside the body politic that he's just mining for political advantage. And the question is, are those political forces so strong that they're ultimately going to end up tearing the country apart? I don't think that's likely, but for the first time in my life, I really begin to wonder where this train is headed.
Interesting. Steve Walt.
I want to pick up on that. I mean, the founding fathers of this country, when creating that republic, understood, you know, that there's a real danger when any country starts fighting wars all the time, that you immediately empower precisely those coercive institutions, those anti-democratic institutions, because the military, although our military supports democracy, is itself not a democratic institution. Also, once you start fighting wars all the time, and especially wars that are wars of choice, where you're not defending yourself against a foreign invader, you have to start doing a lot of lying. There becomes a lot of dishonesty, right, a lot of threat inflation. You have the missing WMD in Iraq and all of that. So the trends John was just talking about are, I think, accelerated by the fact that we've been waging this imperial enterprise. It was also, remember, Dwight D. Eisenhower back in his farewell address, five-star general, no dove, who warns the country against the growing power of what he calls the military-industrial complex and what his first draft of the speech called the military-industrial congressional complex. And both the founding fathers and Dwight D. Eisenhower understood that once you start creating these very powerful national security institutions, they were going to be hard to control, and they were ultimately going to poison our political discourse in a variety of ways. And I think in some ways, Donald Trump is just the latest continuation of that process, right, of someone who now thinks truth is whatever he decides it wants to be, much the same way that Dick Cheney was telling us what he saw, he wanted us to know, even though it was false.
Speaking of the military-industrial complex and that career path, come back to the personalities here, specifically Mike Pompeo. What do we know about this man? West Point, Harvard Law School, on the law review, but he drifts pretty readily into a small arms manufacturing enterprise in Kansas with West Point pals who are still in his circle. But suddenly, he's a politician and knows all the doors and locks and keys in Washington, it seems. But what more should we know about the people around Trump? They're not exactly the Cheney neocon types. They're not, I don't know what they are, except they're children of Intel and of the biz. Do you know Steve Enever?
I think there's two big stories about Pompeo. One is that the Trump administration foreign policy team, security team, is now a ghost ship led by one pirate, really, Mike Pompeo. He's very important here because Secretary of Defense is an old buddy of his who I think follows his lead on things. The National Security Advisor is not a guy with strong opinions. So Pompeo is a very big figure here. And second is, I think he's the most extreme person who's ever been Secretary of State. He's sort of outside the white lines in ways that no other Secretary of State ever has been. If you just look at his history in Congress, he and Jim Jordan of Ohio dissented from the House Intelligence Committee's report on Benghazi, which was written by Trey Gowdy and a bunch of extremely conservative Republican Congress members. But it wasn't far out enough for Mike Pompeo, who wrote his own sort of, shall we say, highly fictional account of what had happened. And to me, it's like, holy mackerel, this guy isn't tethered to reality. He has he's claimed that he's pushed back as CIA director against the CIA's report that Iran was observing the JCPOA. And everyone in Europe, every intelligence agency, every U.S. agency all said they were, and no evidence has come to light since then that they weren't. But Pompeo pushed back. He's we've never seen a Secretary of State quite like this. And he's got just signs of and third, he's very undistinguished in terms of his sort of background in foreign policy. This is not a guy who spent his history, you know, he's not a Henry Kissinger who you may disagree with him, but he's spent a lot of time in the Widener stacks reading up. He spent his time
And writing his doctrine or his views or his arguments, none of which I liked, but it's sort of on the record. There's an open book there of a public man.
Correct.
Also, the thing about Pompeo, he's very smart, very arrogant. The way he deals with questions, legitimate questions, say, raised by the press, raised by others, is simply to treat them with contempt, that they're beneath his attention. So you've got a guy who's, dealing with a bit of a tabula rasa president who really doesn't understand international affairs at all. Pompeo, smart, military background, has ideas, has ambitions as well, I think has figured out how to manipulate President Trump. And as Steve was saying, is probably the critical figure in driving our policy towards Iran, which it's important to note has been a complete failure. right? The United States was in far better shape, and the rest of the world was in far better shape before Trump became president, before he tore up the nuclear agreement, before we adopted the policy of maximum pressure, which then got forced, really, Iran to start reacting in ways that led to the most recent crisis, led to an attack on Saudi oil facilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This has been a complete disaster. Iran, of course, has not either collapsed or caved in to our vague and unspecified demands, and yet they're continuing to push this particular line.
I want to throw out a wild hypothetical. In the overall history of empires up and down, and they all come down sooner or later, there's a doctor out there who treats aging empires. And Uncle Sam walks in and says, not feeling so hot, how am I doing? The doctor, I could imagine the doctor saying either of two things. One, look, you've lost your character and maybe your mind. You're at the dementia and severe addiction point of arrogance, militarism, secrecy. You've forgotten who you were and what is expected of you. You've lost your base of belief at home, too, by the way, Uncle. You're close to moral, political, financial ruin. It'll be over soon. He could also say, Guy, you can pick a fly off the wall in Timbuktu with your drones. Nobody's there to challenge you. China's 10 years away at a military level, or say. Keep it up. It's not pretty, but you're winning. What does the doctor say, John Mearsheimer?
Chris, aren't you missing the central question here?
Probably. Go for it.
The central question is, what's caused this problem? How did we ever end up in this mess?
Yeah,
that's the central issue here. The United States is a country that has a huge amount of human capital. It's not like we have a bunch of uneducated people who don't know their head from their foot. We have people who go to the best schools in the world in charge of foreign policy. I mean, as you said, describing Mike Pompeo, he was first in his class at West Point. He was a distinguished graduate at Harvard Law School. You just sort of scratch your head and say, how did he end up becoming the person he is today? He is, as Steve Van Emmer said, a third-rate Secretary of State at best. We've never seen anybody as bad as him. How could this happen in the United States of America? How could we end up electing Donald Trump? There must be something fundamentally wrong here.
You asked this question before. 10 years ago, John, in a conversation we had, you said, how did this country, with all these smart people, miss the absolute catastrophe of Iraq, but also the economic meltdown?
But it's worse now, Chris. I know I said that 10 years ago. It was true then. But the situation is worse now. We've not learned anything. And the policymakers who we have now are worse than the policymakers we had then.
Valentin, what are we doing wrong?
Oh, a lot. As I observe and listen to Trump and Pompeo and these people, what I hear are echoes of 2002 and 2003. I mean, this is a reenactment of Bush and his axis of evil. Iran is not the same as Iraq. It will not roll over and be destroyed as easily as poor Iraq was. But that's what they have in mind. And, Pompeo is arrogant and awful, and we've seen this before. I mean, is he more arrogant than the cabal that was around Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, that gang? Again, I just see this as a continuous display of American obsession with maintaining power and hegemony around the world. And now and then you will have somewhat more sophisticated, members of the political class and people in government, someone like a Bill Clinton, John Kerry. But for the most part, it is still all about maintaining American power. And we have to stop that. And we've got to, there's so much that needs to be done. And with the Middle East, I would argue that the first thing we have to do is get rid of the bases. That is so provocative, and it's very aggressive.
Steve Walt, can you explain this falling out of
out of luck here?
Well, I think there's several parts of it. I mean, here at home, there's a variety of things. One is that, large chunks of the population were not lifted up by globalization, did not benefit economically from it, and were concerned or worried and turned to people like Trump. I think our media institutions have not performed well over the last 25 years or so in a variety of ways. We've got deeply corrupt institutions where truth-telling has become relatively rare. I think we're now seeing some of the flaws in our sacred constitution, right, where we've had at least two presidential elections in the last 20 years where the candidate who got the majority of the votes did not become president because we've got this strange institution of an electoral college and a Senate representation system that that empowers relatively low population states as much as states like California or Texas or New York as well. So all of these things I think have contributed to that. But I wanted to push back on your doctor there for a second. I mean, this does have consequences. If you ask yourself who has probably been smiling about the events of the last 2 weeks, it's got to be Xi Jinping, right? That if you're worried about American security over the longer term, you'd worry about the rivalry we're going to have with China. Mm-hmm. And you would therefore not want to be squandering enormous amounts of time, money, political capital, reputation over countries that aren't particularly important. You wouldn't want China to dominate the world of artificial intelligence. You wouldn't want China to dominate the next generation of high technology, et cetera.
Would you want anybody dominating that game of artificial intelligence? But let me just ask, one thing we haven't mentioned, but it's part of the nightmare suddenly, is this rather casual entry of cyber weapons into the conduct of war without consultation of an ally, of a congressperson or whatnot. He said, go for him, and bing, he's gone. This is I don't know what to say. First of all, we are not the only people who will have this technology. We can't begin to imagine how we would respond to, some heavy dude at West Point is taken out by a Chinese drone, or much less, a newspaper editor or a professor or captain of industry. But it's all being treated like, hey, well, that's the way it is now. And we know we can see him everywhere and zap him, gone.
This is a very dangerous trend, right? Where the wise countries, the desire for vengeance is often there, this idea that taking out bad guys will solve problems. But wise countries have always understood this was a bad idea, that during the Cold War, we never tried to assassinate Khrushchev. We never tried to go after Kosygin or Brezhnev. We did try to go after Castro, and we now look back on that as having been a huge mistake, both ethically and politically. But by and large, there's been a norm among countries that they would not attack each other's officials. That norm has been breaking down in recent decades with targeted killings of various kinds, starting with so-called terrorists, now starting to spread into government officials like General Soleimani of Iran. And the point is, do we really want to live in a world where this becomes commonplace, where every American ambassador has to feel like he's walking around or she's walking around with a bullseye on their back?
And 10, 20 years of American practice has sort of legitimized it, or certainly stopped us from shouting outrage.
Yeah, exactly. So if Vladimir Putin ordered the execution of the president of Ukraine, right?
He has ordered a few executions, right?
Of course, but not against serving government officials. And that's essentially what we did last week. It was as if Iran had gone after the head of the Central Intelligence Agency or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, something like that. That's been a norm that usually hasn't been violated, and it's been better for the world that be the case. And we've now opened that door a little wider.
Wake up the Republic, Steve Enneboro. How are we going
to me,
this?
To me, sort of way to the key point that cyber war plays in the possibility of a conflict with Iran is I believe we're very vulnerable to a cyber attack on our infrastructure. We've basically foolishly designed our key national assets, from the power grid to the electric to the water supply to the entire financial system, by plugging it into the net. And that means bad foreign actors who know what they're doing can cause tremendous damage, I believe. This is a question mark. It's not been tested, but I believe they can cause tremendous damage. If we do pursue regime change in Iran, I believe they are going to unleash cyber war on us.
Wow.
regimes don't suffer their own demise peacefully, and we are going to see there's a grave threat. We'll get very badly hurt.
We're getting worried, and we're going to do this again. Thank you. John Mearsheimer in Chicago, Steve Walt, Stephen Ivra, and Valentin Mogadam in our studio in Boston. Thanks also to the marvelous Huss Banai in Indiana. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of energetic, idea-driven podcasts. Check out Culture Hustlers this week and What Makes an Artist at culturehustlers.com. Our show was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our warrior for peace. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.